Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is an interesting week for us, Tim.
Yeah, it is.
Aside from what's going on in the world around us, we've got a fun guest that's joining us. He was with us on True Crime Tuesday. If you missed that episode, shame on you. Go subscribe. It's a damn good show. You guys should be listening to it. But we've got our guest back. Not the same topic. Whole new topic. That's how versatile this guy is. Been a friend of our show for going on 14 years, and he is back. He's got a book out called A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. This book came out in April 2019. We have a link up for that book on today's program, so you can find it directly and a link right to Troy Taylor's website. One of the best paranormal authors out there, folks. You are locked up. You've got 3 to 4 weeks to yourself. Get yourself a Kindle version of one of these books or order one of the books and read them. Keep yourself entertained, occupied, and enlightened. Troy Taylor, welcome back to the program, sir.
Hey, good to be here, as always.
Yeah. So listen, music is going to be one of my go-tos during this time of solace, right? I'm planning on forcing my children to expand their horizons outside of what they think is music at this point.
You have a captive audience.
Yes. And we're going to start going through the musical catalogs of some of the greatest 80s one-hit wonders and rock and roll legends on the planet. But I just thought it'd be great, too, in this case, to kind of hear some of the stories and backstories behind some of the history of these songs, music, and you know, there's been so much said about the devil's music and rock and roll ushered in. And for, you know, a lot of people think it's the rock and roll era that kind of ushered in the devil's music. It starts long before that, doesn't it, Troy?
Yeah. That was one of the things I wanted to do with this is I looked at all of these different versions of things that people called the devil's music, dating all the way back to the Middle Ages with certain notes, you know, that were not allowed to be played in churches and things because it was thought that it might summon the devil. You might recognize one of the notes because it's, you know, the really cool part of Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix. That's the note. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. That tritone note is what the church did not allow to be played in churches. And so, you know, that was the beginning of the devil's music. But I mean, it's had a million variations over the years.
So do you think at some point somebody was shaking their fist saying, oh, these kids and their Gregorian chant music?
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, that's a perfect example. Oh, so, yeah. Man. So it's been around forever. I mean, it's you know, it started then and it just keeps going.
What made these tritone notes, was it just something that was offensive to the ear? So they just decided it must be of the devil?
No, this is even better. There's actually a space. There's a certain space within those notes that it's believed that that pause was open for the devil to insert himself into the music. I'm not kidding. But I mean, you got to look at the time period, you know, I mean, we're looking at where the devil was everywhere back then. You know, people could only do things on certain days. They could only, you know, eat certain things. Women and men, you know, that were married could only have sex on certain days. And I mean, there was, you know, it didn't leave a lot of room because it could be.
Yeah,
you heard me.
Has that changed?
Well, yeah, I've heard it has. That's the rumor that's out there.
So
it would be like, well, you couldn't do it within so many days of, you know, a certain holiday or a certain prayer day. And by the time you got done with it, there were like, you know, 8 days out of the month that, or that were okay, if even that. So it was, yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff.
Eight days,
that's
you
how
say.
This stuff got started. Yeah. And
well,
but that's, well, that's
up when it was, game.
Yeah, that's when it was allowed. I didn't say that's when it happened.
Oh,
you know? Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. You know, it's you mentioned that there's this space in the music where they feel the devil could enter. I went to a Christian grade school, and mm-hmm. we had a dance, and I remember them telling us to leave room for Jesus between us.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, let him get his own date. You know, if
exactly.
the God is not good enough on your resume to get you some action, I don't know what is. But yeah, that's funny. So there was they thought in these notes. So was it like a musical invitation, and it would open that, if you would, portal to allow the devil to influence?
I'm not even sure they were thinking that far ahead. I mean, this was just one of those unnecessary rules that popped up at a time when people were, you know, hanging and burning witches at the stake. So, I mean, you know, it really didn't take a lot to come up with something crazy. But those were the first devil's notes. And then, you know, around that time, you know, as we kind of progressed further on, there were certain songs that were believed to be satanic that couldn't be played. There were certain musicians who, rumor had it, you know, had deals with the devil. I mean, and this was all still in the years of the, you know, Enlightenment and things like that, before we even get up to, you know, the jazz era, which of course was devil's music, or the blues, which again, devil's music. And then, you know, after that, it was rock and roll. So, but yeah, it's it traces sort of a history in between, you know, that was the plan with the book. And then of course it, you know, as most of my books do, I go down rabbit holes and spiral out of control on curses and things. So, you know, the initial plan was that, yes.
Well, I know there's a documentary called The Crossroads on Netflix that mm-hmm. I just started, about Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
This is always kind of an interesting story to start with. This is a blues man. And as I understand from even just watching the first 10 minutes, this was a blues man who is not really that talented a musician. And then something bizarre takes place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, and it's interesting because you can read 10 different books about Robert Johnson. And while they might all contain an allusion to this story, some of them will swear it's not true. Some of them will swear it is true. But it is, and as far as I'm concerned, the greatest blues legend and really the introduction to rock and roll legend there is. This Robert Johnson was just this young guy who had started playing, you know, trying to play the blues, wasn't very good at it, literally got booed off the stage. And then he left, shows up again 9 months later and starts playing again. And now the crowd was said to be chilled and spooked by the transformation between how he'd been 9 months before. Well, legend had it that he had gone out to a crossroads on Highway 61 in Mississippi one night and then had sold his soul to the devil in exchange for talent and a handful of songs. And he became famous very quickly. And the legend has it he was haunted in his dreams that the devil was after him, that was chasing him down a dirt road. And he did a lot of songs like Me and the Devil Blues, Hellhound on My Trail, and of course Crossroads Blues, which is the most famous version, which has been covered by a whole bunch of different bands. And then in the book, I actually trace how many bands that covered Crossroad Blues had terrible things happen to them. So there is actually a curse not only on Robert Johnson, but on the song Crossroads Blues, too. But anyway, the devil said, or the story goes that the devil only allowed Robert Johnson to live until he was 27. And there are a couple of different versions of how he died, but most of them seem to agree that he was poisoned by a club owner who suspected him of seducing his wife. So he was buried in an unmarked grave in one of the local cemeteries. And there are actually two different cemeteries that claim to have Robert Johnson buried there. That's how good his stories are. But that story with the blues then turning into rock and roll is one of the things that has made, you know, rock and roll and, you know, the devil, you know, completely connected after all these years. I mean, that's where the idea of the devil's music and rock and roll being the devil's music came from. And it's all been connected to this over the years. So, but that's how it got started. I mean, the Robert Johnson story is a very cool story, whether you believe in, you know, curses or deals with the devil or anything else. It's still a pretty cool story. So,
well, are we able to trace back the mythos of this deal with the devil? Was it something he admitted to? I would guess that'd be something he wouldn't be real forthcoming.
Well, you know, I wouldn't think so either. And that's been kind of the debate on it, is people say, oh, well, you know, he never said this, or, you know, and they will tell you, and I, you know, documented this in the book, that he did have a teacher who supposedly taught him the blues during that 9 months. But then, of course, there are lots of stories around that too, claiming that, you know, this teacher was someone that no one could find. There were, you know, taught him how to play in a graveyard. I mean, it's all this kinds of stuff, and it really boiled down to the fact that he was a I guess a white Jewish man that taught him how to play. His name was Ike Zimmerman, which is an odd name for a blues man, but that's the story. Robert did claim that he learned to play the guitar at night in old churchyards. And of course, then, you know, the story still went that Zimmerman was, of course, the devil in disguise. I mean, it was just whatever people wanted to believe about this story is really what it comes down to. And yep. So it made a great story about a blues man. It's the perfect story. That's the perfect rock and roll legend of how it all begins, that it couldn't have just been a guy who really discovered his inner talent. He had to have gotten this from the devil. And so all of the music was then, you know, inoculated with, you know, demonic forces, I guess you would say, at least to people who believe in that sort of thing. So,
and the last name was Zimmerman, just like Bob Dylan's.
Bob Dylan, right.
Which would make complete sense on how he got so popular.
Yeah. Yeah. So who knows? I know it's just one of those things, but it's, I love the story. Even people who want to just dismiss it and say, oh no, that, you know, nothing like that ever happened. And I'm not sitting here trying to convince people that Robert Johnson made a deal with the devil at the crossroads, but that story's become so ingrained in our lore. And, you know, stories of deals with the devil at the crossroads, man, go back hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, that's a fairly common thing, not only in Europe, but it was a big part of, you know, local lore in the Deep South at the time, you know, that you could go to the crossroads and make a deal. And that's, you know, what they said Robert Johnson did. And, you know, it probably got started by some saying something, how'd this guy get so good? Oh, well, you know, it probably sold his soul to the devil, you know, and off we went. So, but it's still a great story.
Well, let's now you kind of tempted us here with the aspect of his song being kind of cursed and how it's affected other people. So can you give us a little bit of that background as well?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. A big part of the book became about curses and about, you know, music curses, especially the Buddy Holly curse is a big one. The Grand Ole Opry curse is another big one. And there's been a lot of little ones too, but the Crossroad Blues song, you know, first of all, it's made famous by the guy who started the original founder of the 27 Club, which is a, you know, a really infamous curse that is a lot bigger than people realize. There have been a lot more singers died at 27 than just the top five that we all think about, you know, and well, I'm sure we'll get to that, because that's, you can't not talk about these curses and leave it out. But one of the first groups that's said to have been affected, especially by the Crossroad Blues curse, were the Allman Brothers. They made that song famous for the first time after Robert Johnson, and they had a lot of tragedy. You know, Dwayne Allman was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was only 24. And then to make things worse, you know, another band member died in a motorcycle accident almost at the exact same intersection where Dwayne had died. So that was bad enough. But Barry Oakley, that was who died. He died at almost the same spot. And there were quite a few other things that happened to the band that, you know, went on over time, about the different members were killed, different bad things happened to them. Eric Clapton is probably, with Cream's, probably the most famous most recent version of Crossroad Blues. And while he's still alive, I think we can say that he's had his more than fair share of bad luck over the years with drug addictions. And of course, his son that fell from the window of the hotel and died. George Harrison, was a good friend of his. They got into problems with, between Patty Boyd, and that was who, some of his songs were about, and they ended up, a lot of bad things happened to him too. I mean, I think the worst of it would be his son dying. But there were others. There were a few other people who also got involved in the curse, and that story, did kind of keep being told when it came to Crossroad Blues. They say that the story goes that one of the last victims of the curse, and who also was part of the 27 Club, who was working on an acoustic version of Crossroad Blues shortly before he died, was Kurt Cobain. And whether or not you want to tie that into the Crossroad Blues curse or you want to tie it into the 27 Club, it's bad either way. So you've got bad things happening with this song. And, there's a lot more detail in the book, but it's just one of those stories. Rock and roll and musicians are a superstitious bunch, I will tell you that. So it's a lot of good stories out there.
Do the bands themselves look at these songs and look at them as being cursed, or has it always been something they just kind of roll their eyes at and ignore?
You know, it varies. There are a lot of people who roll their eyes at this. And honestly, in the book, I roll my eyes at a lot of it because some of it is supposed to be a curse. And I kind of just go, well, if you want to believe in the curse, there it is, but I think it goes both ways. For a long time, the way that people would harass Led Zeppelin about their alleged deal with the devil, and they would get angry about it, but on the other hand, here's Jimmy Page with this gigantic occult collection. So I think it goes, back and forth and all over the place. I think it depends a lot on what's popular and what's of interest at the time. In the late 60s and early 70s, and through the 70s, it was really cool to be, linked to something satanic. It was cool for your image, just like some of the hair band people, in the early 80s. You had Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath. It looked really cool to be linked to this stuff. But if you ask them about it, they go, oh, no, I don't want anything to do with that stuff. This is just our image. So I think it really is all over the place. But some of the curses I found that they do gain their believers. The Grand Ole Opry curse was a really particular one. The Grand Ole Opry, and I know it's not rock and roll, but it was such a famous curse, and there's so many people that crossed over between the two that you could really mix it up. But the Grand Ole Opry, the curse seemed to be more connected to people who performed at the building, because the original Ryman Auditorium, because the Grand Ole Opry is pretty much wherever you want to put it on. It's moved to several different buildings over the years, but it seemed that those who performed at the Ryman were the ones who seemed to be most affected by it. And we're talking about, Hank Williams, who died tragically, who was there in the early days of the Grand Ole Opry. Johnny Horton, the guy that sang the Battle in New Orleans song, died in a tragic automobile accident. Patsy Cline, we know how she died. She died in a plane crash, and she was very connected to the Opry, of course. There was a good friend of hers, Jack Anglin, who was killed on his way to her funeral, was also a performer at the Opry. Quite a few people, Texas Ruby, Agnes Owen, Jim Reeves, all of these people died under very tragic circumstances. And yes, you could put that off and say, well, you're talking about a bunch of people that were, at the golden era of country music, who were living a pretty hard, fast life, and so is it really a surprise that Hank Williams drank himself to death and died in his car? But then you get people like, String Bean Akeman from Hee Haw, who was just this country boy who'd made good playing the banjo and people loved him. And then he was murdered when some guys broke into his house to rob him. So, you just don't know, what was going to be next. And a lot of these people were not people that you would expect to have died under very violent circumstances, and yet there was a whole string of them. And in the 70s, which really the curse kind of came to an end in the 70s when the Opry moved out to Opryland and kind of the Ryman stopped being used for the Grand Old Opry. But people were talking about the curse. That there are a lot of quotes in the book from music stars and things that talked about all the bad luck that was happening to people who played the Opry. So it really varies. It depends on the artist. It depends on the circumstances and the situation, I think.
Now, I'm sorry, did you explain why did they think the Grand Old Opry was so cursed?
No idea. That's no idea. That's the thing about all these curses that I found, that nobody really seems to know how or why they got started. I mean, you can start with Buddy Holly. I mean, here's a guy who had a very successful career and, you know, but then died young with the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens in a plane crash. And it seems like everyone connected to Buddy in one way or another after that. There were performers that he had helped get started. There were guys who used to tour with him or were close friends who suddenly ended up having a big string of bad luck, like Eddie Cochran. I mean, Eddie was in a terrible car accident with Gene Vincent. I mean, these were two guys that were like the beginning of, you know, rock and roll with Buddy Holly. They were really big. And, you know, Eddie died the next morning after this car crash that he was in, after finding out that Buddy had died. A lot of the guys that were playing in the Crickets, who had been his backup band, several of them, one of them died in a plane crash. Another one died in a car accident. I mean, it was just like one thing after another with these people that were connected. Bobby Fuller, who Buddy's parents had helped get started with his career, was murdered in Hollywood after moving out to California, and his murder's never been solved. And so there were a lot of people that were connected in some way to Billy. Some very, and that's where the curse gets a little silly, in my opinion. There are a number of people who, you know, are associated with the curse, but only because they were, you know, went to a movie about Buddy Holly, or, you know, but they were musicians. So the story got started. I mean, that's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you kind of have to take with a big grain of salt. Or, you know, there was, and Ricky Nelson, who died in a plane crash, also, you know, got started around the same time as Buddy. And there were a lot of connections between him and Buddy Holly. But the big thing was, is that this is where people like to connect him to, is that his last recordings were covers of Buddy Holly songs. And then the night he died on December 30th of 85, the last song he played at his show was Buddy Holly's Rave On, and got on the plane and it crashed. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a stretch. Del Shannon, too. He was Del Shannon, which, you know, most people remember from, you know, they know like Runaway and some of his songs and stuff. But he was a friend of Buddy's. He started out around the same time, and he was actually touring with a tribute show to Buddy Holly. At the time, it was, you know, bringing back some of the old rockers, and they were bringing them back. And this was in 1990, I believe. Yeah. And the last place that he played was the Surf Ballroom on February 3rd of 1990, the last place Buddy Holly played, the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death. And the last song he played was a Buddy Holly song, and his backup band that night was the Reunited Crickets that had played with Buddy Holly. So that one is not so much, but he didn't die in an accident. He committed suicide, but it was right after that. So that's kind of where they, you know, draw the line between Del Shannon and the Buddy Holly curse. And the really bad thing about Del Shannon is that at that time they were going to ask him to take Roy Orbison's place in the Traveling Wilburys, because Roy Orbison had just passed away, and Del had been without a job for years. You know, he was doing this revival thing to try to pay the bills, and that would have been his chance to really take off again, hopefully, you know, because they that was a pretty popular band in the early 90s.
Yeah, it was.
And then he, not knowing anything about it, committed suicide right before he was asked to join the band. So it's a sad story. It's a tragic story. How it links to Buddy Holly, there's, you know, there's a lot of weird little coincidences there. But That's the nature of these curses, though. You know, these music curses are a lot of coincidences. And, you know, the only time you really kind of start to think, and I don't know if you take them super seriously or not, but once you get into the stories about the 27 Club, that's a lot of people to die at the exact same age.
Yeah,
know?
That
but
is.
Again, though, you got to look at the majority of these people died under circumstances that were not exactly, I mean, yes, they were tragic, but they weren't accidents for the most part.
Right.
I mean, most of them were self-imposed deaths.
You're living those hard lives, drinking, taking drugs, driving fast, staying up late, going to bed, you know, getting up early, exhaustion, just wearing down their immune system. So, yeah, it's not, but it's weird that it's at the age exactly of 27. Right. That's the really screwed up thing. I was going to mention to you, you know, we actually were doing a show, about 8 years ago, live on our former radio station, and Rick Nelson's pilot called us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you remember that, Tim?
I do, yes.
Yeah. He listens to the show and called in and answered some questions for us on that, because, you know, there was a lot surrounding the death of Rick Nelson. Oh, he was freebasing cocaine. It exploded. It was all this. And this guy said it all straight. He's like, no, it was a crappy heater on the plane. He had complained about it. And he was one of the only, I think he and the other guy are the only two that survived the plane accident. He crawled out through the front window, but said just what a lovely guy Rick Nelson was. But yeah, you look at, now, obviously, he, you know, far outlived the age of 27 and, you know, but died in a tragedy. Before we get into the 27 Club, though, if you look at how many celebrities die in plane accidents or helicopter accidents, that to me seems like, listen, I understand those things happen, but the stunning and staggering amount of celebrities, especially in the musical genre, that have died in aircraft related incidents, that's pretty bizarre as well.
It is. And really, but on the other hand, you can look at it and say, well, here are people who are traveling by plane a lot more often than your average person. So, I mean, their percentages are going to go up, but still, I mean, especially when you go back and you think about having, you know, three of the biggest pop stars at the time, Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens, all in the same plane and dying at the same time at the height of their career, you know, and all of them had premonitions of an early death. I don't know. A lot of people don't realize that, but Buddy's wife used to dream about him dying in an airplane and he laughed it off. The Big Bopper had premonitions of dying by plane. And Ritchie Valens was terrified of flying because if you've seen the movie, if you've seen La Bamba, and even if you haven't read anything about Ritchie, he was supposed to be at school one day when a plane went down over his school and killed his best friend. And his friend Richie would have been killed too if he had been there, but his best friend died. And so he was terrified of flying and would do anything not to have to fly. And so their entire tour that winter had been by bus, but the weather had gotten so bad and the heater was broken on the bus and they were all sick. They had colds. And so finally they're like, you know, we've got to get some rest. And so we're going to take this flight. And I'm sure you know the story about, you know, one of the musicians that was playing in Buddy's band was Waylon Jennings, who lost the coin toss to another guy. And so he wasn't on the plane because he'd lost the coin toss. So he talked about that a lot, as you can imagine, as the years went by. So, planes are bad.
I wonder how much survivor's guilt he had to deal with.
No kidding.
Feeling that. And not only that, but then, you know, you've got, wasn't it Stevie Ray Vaughan who died in a helicopter accident, I think, after leaving Poplar Creek Amphitheater in Illinois.
Right. Yeah, he got tied into the Crossroad Blues curse. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dean Martin's son, and a lot of people forget this, but Dean Martin's son was a musician in the 60s. He died in a plane accident, crashing into the side of a mountain.
I didn't know. Wow.
Yeah, his son, that's pretty much what kind of sent Dean Martin spiraling out of control afterwards. Yeah, he crashed into a plane on the side of a mountain in California.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming how how creepy it is when it comes to musical celebrities. And that, you know, I wonder if we looked at it across the board, you know, are there TV and movie celebrities that have died the same way? But none seem to really come to mind. But where it comes to musicians, I'd be sweating getting on a plane anytime if I was a musician, just because it seems like every time you turn around, you hear about some death that was associated with an airline.
Yeah, yeah. I know there are some movie ones. I mean, I always think of Carol Lombard, Clark Gable's wife, died in a plane crash when she was on a war bonds trip around the country during World War II, because he never really recovered from her death. So that's, I mean, that pops into my head. But other than that, you're right. I don't think of as many, I guess, because musicians have to tour so much, you know, and where actors really don't. So,
right.
And they travel by plane, but they're not forced to.
You got, like you said, Patsy Cline in 63, mm-hmm. Ricky Nelson right. in 85, Leonard Skinner, member
yeah.
from
oh, yeah.
Steve
yeah.
Gaines and his sister, Cassie Gaines, a backup singer, Otis Redding.
Oh, yeah, Otis Redding, right, right.
Randy Rhoads in 82,
yeah, yeah.
Will Rogers in 35. How about Reba? I think her band, if I remember correctly, Reba McEntire's entire band died in a plane accident.
No kidding? Wow, I didn't know that. Tim, no, I believe that? You. But yeah, I don't.
It was either a bus crash or airplane.
Oh, no, this is it. 29th anniversary of plane crash. Reba McEntire remembers band members and tour manager.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. On March 16th. Wow. Talk about that timing. March 16th, 1991. Seven members of Reba's entire band and her tour manager, Jim Hammond, were killed near San Diego, California, after their plane crashed into the side of a mountain.
Wow. I wonder why she wasn't on the plane. Makes you wonder. I mean,
yeah.
if she lucked out somehow, you know?
Yeah. And you've got, I'm just looking at this list that popped up, just taking a quick glance at it. Cause I'm like, maybe I'm just overthinking, and maybe it's like Buddy Holly, Big Bopper, Richie Valens, two or three more. And it seems right. like there's a lot more, but yeah, you know, Buddy Holly, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Patsy Cline, Richie Valens, Big Bopper, Leonard Skinner, Aaliyah, Otis Redding, Ricky yeah. Nelson, Jim Croce, the barkeep.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Assassins, I don't know that band, but Passion Fruit, the band died. Glenn Miller.
Oh, John well,
Denver.
True.
Yeah. How did we forget John
Oh,
Denver?
Yeah, we did forget about John Denver, didn't we?
Yeah. Jenny Rivera, those are just the top ones that came up looking at it. And you think, boy, that's, you know, but again, out of the millions of musicians and singers, you know, that's not horrible. I'm sure drugs have taken the lives of many more than that, sure. but it just, it again, stands out to you so much.
Hmm. Yeah, it's, yeah, I didn't think about it that way, but you're absolutely right. So.
From the creators of Cold Case Files and PD Stories comes the next great true crime podcast, I Survived. Every week, I Survived presents chilling first-person accounts from people who overcame deadly situations, allowing the survivors to describe the events as they unfolded and how they made it out alive. If you love true crime, you're going to love I Survived. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, PodcastOne.com, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps, so you can get new episodes every week.
Music, mayhem, magic, murder, death, cults, all kinds of weird stuff. That's what we're talking about today. Troy Taylor's book, A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. We have a link to that book on today's program. You can find it. Pick it up for yourself. Again, we're just doing kind of a glossary look at a lot of these stories and histories. But folks, there's so much more to examine in these strange deaths and just overall the weird twists of rock and roll history and legends that have existed out there. Let's, you know, we've talked about some of the tragedies in the plane accidents, and, you know, you talked about some of the early ideas of the devil's music and even some curses. And you mentioned the curse of what is it? The Crossroad Blues?
Yeah. Yeah.
What other curses jump to mind before we really kind of rack into the 27 Club and some of the other aspects?
Well, I mentioned the Grand Ole Opry curse and I talked about the Buddy Holly curse. I mean, those are really the big ones. The Crossroad Blues curse is one that's not widely known. But it's one that, you know, once you start putting things together with it, you know, you start to find these different tragedies that are linked with the song. And then after that, you really get into the 27 Club as far as the ones that are the most famous of them. And, you know, as we've already mentioned, we talked about Robert Johnson, and he's sort of the founding member. This is kind of where the lists begin. And there may be other people, you know, further back in history, but as far as recording musicians and things, it really starts with Robert Johnson dying at 27. And again, it's hard to know exactly under what circumstances he died, because it's all pretty mysterious, but that's supposed to be sort of the beginning of the cursed club that no one really wants to be a member of. A lot of times when you see these lists, they jump right to Brian Jones, but there were actually a couple of other 27-year-old performers that died before he did. Jesse Belvin was a rhythm and blues singer. He was known for songs like Earth Angel. You might know that song, or Good Night, My Love. Yeah, he died. He died at 27 in a car crash in 1960, 4 hours after performing in his last concert, and he was 27. 1964, the next on the list was Rudy Lewis. He was a later member of the Drifters. He did not, or actually a little bit earlier member, because he did not perform on Under the Boardwalk, but he did perform on Some Kind of Wonderful and Up on the Roof and a few other things. And he died from a drug overdose, as you'll find that happens quite a bit in this club, unfortunately. But he was 27. And then it goes to Brian Jones, the member of the Rolling Stones, who had a pretty, you know, his life was a kind of a mess. I mean, things were all over the place for him. You know, he'd started the band with, you know, he really started the band, and then he got Mick Jagger and Keith Richards on board, and he sort of lost control of the band because he had really always wanted to do this kind of bluesy thing, which is how they first started. And they took it in another direction and eventually forced him out. But he'd had, you know, he had a pretty crazy life anyway, a lot of drugs, a lot of women, a lot of, you know, a lot of children that he didn't claim. I mean, just the life of a 60s rock star, I guess, really is how you would look at it. But he died at 27 at his home. The house had actually been owned by A.A. Milne, the guy that wrote the Winnie the Pooh books. And the woods behind his house were the 100-acre woods from the story.
Oh, wow.
But Yeah. So, but he died in his swimming pool. And that's one thing you'll find about all of these, or most of these deaths, not all of them, but a lot of them, you'll find that there are mysterious circumstances involved and a lot of raised questions and a lot of unanswered questions. And he drowned in this pool, believed to be, you know, high, and just, you know, didn't get out of the water and drowned. But then there have been a lot of claims that he was murdered, that there had been someone at the pool that night, some people he'd had a disagreement with, who was doing some work on the house, that they had forced him underwater. And there were eyewitnesses who saw it, and then there weren't. And so there's a lot of questions about exactly how he died. But the main thing was, is that he died at 27. And that was where it all boiled down to. In 1970, Blind Al Wilson from Canned Heat died, and he died early, but again, it was a case of, I don't know, there's a lot of questions about him as well as exactly what happened. He liked to sleep outside, and that's where he was found. They were getting ready to go on tour the following day, but his body was found in his sleeping bag with a bottle of sleeping pills. Some say he committed suicide. Again, some say it was just an accidental overdose. Well, we'll never know. You know, it's just one of those things that there's no way that we can ever know exactly what happened. And then the next on the list was Jimi Hendrix, who died in 1970, in September of 1970, at his girlfriend's apartment in England. And again, there are all these questions about what happened. He took some of her sleeping pills. Some say he took too many. And he vomited in his sleep and choked to death. Some said it was an overdose, you know, that he was, you know, but there's all kinds of conspiracies. I mean, there are so many conspiracies about Jimi Hendrix's death that some people claim that he was murdered by the FBI. So because there was a file on him with the FBI and all this stuff. I mean, there's some really crazy conspiracies about Jimi Hendrix. And really, I just think it was either, you know, he took too many. I don't think he did it on purpose. I think it was an accidental death. But whether or not it could be prevented, I think, is whether or not where the big question lies with him. Janis Joplin, always next on the list. She, you know, died of an overdose in Hollywood at her hotel at 27. And this was somebody who had incredible talent, as we all know. I mean, but she also had a very heavy drinking and heroin problem. So, you know, it was you almost want to say inevitable, unfortunately, but on the other hand, still, she was only 27. And, you know, it's anybody with that kind of talent and had that kind of promise, it's just tragic to see someone die at that age. But, you know, she really kind of lived, I guess you'd say she lived every moment of her life, of her 27 years. But on the other hand, you know, what a tragedy. But she was next on the list. Grateful Dead member Ron Pigpen McKiernan died at 27. And then we start to get into some of the ones that aren't well known, like Pete Ham of Badfinger committed suicide. He hung himself. He was 27. Pete DeFreitas from Echo and the Bunnymen died in a motorcycle accident. So he didn't actually die as so many of the other ones did. Mia Zapata, she was an early part of the grunge movement, and she was in a band called The Gits, quite a few things, but she was murdered in Seattle. So she, you know, again, didn't drink herself to death or die in an accident. She was murdered. And I'm not even going to, as we segue into Kurt Cobain, let's just leave the whole murdered thing out of it, because right. That seems to be the big question as to what happened there. But as far as really what's commonly believed, Kurt shot himself. And I think that's probably accurate. I always thought at the time, I remember when, you know, it hasn't been that long ago. I remember when all that happened. And it seemed like whenever you heard that Kurt Cobain had killed himself, you kind of went, well, that's, you know, we knew it was coming. But the question wasn't whether he'd do it, it was when, you know, because that seemed like a guy who was on a spiral from as soon as he became famous, you know. So, but there were other people after him, Kristen Pfaff, Richie Edwards from Manic Street Preachers, and there's a lot of people on the list. Amy Winehouse is the most recent member of the 27 Club. She is the one who most people will remember because it just wasn't that long ago. And again, though, but her lifestyle, I'm sure, led to, you know, her destruction, because she'd been kind of cruising toward that for a couple of years before it finally happened. So she's the most recent member of the list. And I know that you may be sitting here keeping your own list and wondering why I left one out. Did you notice that there's one missing?
Well, I would say something was knocking on the door of forgetfulness, but I wasn't sure if you were thinking the same guy. I am Jim Morrison.
Yeah. I leave Jim Morrison off this list because the book delves into the fact that I don't believe he died at 27. I offer all the evidence as to why. So, because I think if anybody could have gotten away with it, it was him. And he desperately wanted to walk away from it all. And I think he pulled it off. That's just my opinion, but I really
can tell you this, for what it's worth. I know it's too late for the printing of your book, but do you remember Friday Night Videos when MTV was launching?
Yeah.
Cheap version. Friday Night Videos was hosted by Ray Manzarek, mm-hmm. who was pretty blotto, if I recall, on his deal. But he made an offhanded comment about Morrison still being alive.
Oh, did he?
And when they replayed it, that part was taken out. I'm friends with a pretty well-known photographer from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And in one of our first discussions, I just said, so what was it like to work with Jim Morrison? And he actually opened up his portfolio and showed me some really amazing pictures he had that have never been published. Right.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And this was back in the 80s. And we talked about it, and he said, and he flipped to a picture and he said, here's one of Jim that I took about 4 years after he was reportedly dead.
Yeah.
And it just broke into a big smile. And I said, what? Yeah. And he just kind of shrugged and smiled at me, but it looked like an older Jim Morrison, not the big heavy set, like end of his life Elvis, you know, Morrison that we started to see, but he was thin back out and more mature looking. But that to me, you know, his comment, and every now and again, I would needle him through the years and I'm like, were you joking me about Morrison? And he goes, brother, I'm telling you as plain as day, I saw Morrison riding on his motorcycle. I took a photograph of him. I'm just going to let you, you know, I'm telling you, in my opinion, he did not die when they said he did. And it's interesting in the movie, which I love, Val Kilmer was Jim Morrison.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
But I found it interesting the way they end that movie, because it doesn't say Jim Morrison died on September 7th, 1978, or whatever the date was, right? It's and actually, I think that's Keith Moon's death date, if I remember. Yeah. I think it was July 3rd, 71.
July 5th. Yeah, July 5th. Well, yeah, July 2nd. I don't know. See, yeah, but right in there.
It was in July of 71 that he died. But it says, like, at the end, it goes, it is said on July 3rd, 1971, Jim Morrison died. 2 years later, Pamela joined him.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, that's an interesting way to say that.
Yeah.
Isn't it? And yeah. I was fascinated. Do you remember the Eddie and the Cruisers movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That seems to be based, I mean, right on the
concept. Yeah, it was. Right. Story. Yeah.
The second one, not so great. But the first Eddie and the
first
Cruisers
one was really great. Yeah.
So what if I know you don't want to give much away because you put a lot of work into it. But
oh, I don't mind. I don't mind talking about this. I talk about this all the time.
What was one tipping point to you that made you believe that Morrison didn't die?
Well, there were so many. I mean, there were just so many. Nobody really knew what he was doing toward the end of his life. Those last few days were really confusing. I mean, there were a lot of rumors and a lot of stories. But, you know, when his body was found, you know, some people said that he had a heart attack. That was the official cause of death, or that he died of a heroin overdose, which was something that he didn't even use. He was a drinker, heavy, heavy drinker, didn't use heroin and didn't like needles. So he wouldn't have shot up even if he'd snorted it. He still didn't like heroin. But his death certificate was signed by a French doctor that didn't actually exist. That was a good one to start with. But nobody knows exactly where he ended up. When Bill Sidens, the Doors manager, went over to Paris when he got the news that Jim was dead, he showed up on July 6th, which was 3 days later after he had been reported dead. And when he got there to the apartment, Pamela was there and there was a sealed coffin and that death certificate. And that was it. There was nothing else. He never saw Jim. And before he left L.A., Ray Manzarek had called him and said, hey, I need you to be sure. And he said, what are you talking about? He said, and just be sure. Well, he never was sure because he never saw anything. There were only five people at his funeral. When he got home and took Pamela back, it was all over. So the only person whose word we had that Jim was dead was Pamela, who would have lied about anything if Jim told her to.
Right.
And he'd been talking about faking his death as far back as 1967, before they were even super famous. His suggestion to the band at the time to try to get some publicity was for him to fake his death. And then after they got famous and he got sick and tired of that pretty quickly, he kept telling his friends that he wanted to get out of it, he wanted to change his life, and that he came up with the name. He said that if anybody at the record company ever got a call from Africa from a guy named Mojo Rison, that it would be him. And you'll remember in L.A. Woman, he repeats Mojo Rison. I mean, I know that's, now we're getting into, like, you know, the Beatles records being played backwards. But so you can leave that out. But he also, his idea, one of his ideas for this was one of his favorite poets was Arthur Rimbaud. And he had been fascinated with the idea that Rimbaud had become so famous writing poetry when he was young, and then he disappeared for years. And nobody even knew he was alive until like 10 years later, he just sort of showed back up again and died for real pretty young. So I don't know. There's been a lot of stories about it. And like you said, Ray Manzarek even said, he used to say that if anybody could get away with it, faking the death, it would be Jim. And I just have always, just something has never set right with me about the whole thing. And, you know, nobody really saw the body. There are no photographs of the body. A doctor that didn't exist is the one who signed the death certificate. And the whole thing just smells. And I have always thought if anybody could do it, it would have been him. And if there was anybody who was reckless and conceited and ego driven enough to do it, it would have been Morrison. So, you know,
don't hold back. How do you really feel?
I love the guy. No. Don't get me wrong. I love the Doors, and I'm fascinated with Morrison. But I also think that if you had known him, if I had known him in real life, I'm sure I would have thought he was a jerk. Everybody else did. So I'm thinking I probably would have, too. So it's not like I worship him, but on the other hand, I do have a lot of respect for him. And I just really think that with his kind of sense of humor and his kind of way of thinking and his sickness with how much he hated what fame had brought him, really, which is why they went to Paris in the first place to get away from everything, it would have been him. And if it could have been done, he would have done it.
I think you make a compelling argument for it. I'd love to see. I mean, there was a guy, and again, you know, get into some of these weird ass conspiracy deals. It was a rancher who looked an uncanny amount like an older Jim Morrison that people had uncovered like a decade ago. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
You don't sound like
I wasn't convinced. No? I wasn't convinced. You know, I mean, if it had really been him, it would have been a sensation. It wouldn't have been just some kind of internet thing, which is all it turned out to be. And I just wasn't convinced, because I honestly think, well, by now I think he's probably dead. But if it had been, I just don't think that if he'd done this, that he would ever come back. I don't think he would have ever have said, okay, here I am. You know, it wouldn't have been the Eddie and the Cruisers 2 movie, in other words.
Right.
That would never have happened. He would have went away and never come back and would have never needed to. So I think that was one of the big reasons why when that guy kind of came forward, I thought, nah, Morrison would have never have come forward. So I don't see that happening.
Isn't that the beauty of it? If you did and nobody believed you, you kind of made the ultimate deal, right? You hit exactly what you'd always hoped.
I guess you're right. So, good point. And,
hey, folks, you've got a lot of time to kill. There's things to do, movies to catch up on. Since we're talking funny conspiracies and music, treat yourself to the movie Bubba Hotep. For those of you listening to the show, you're going to like horror movies anyway. This is a hell of a horror movie. It is a comedy horror movie starring Bruce Campbell as Elvis Presley, the African-American actor Ossie Davis as JFK, and they're living in an old folks home together, fighting an evil soul sucking mummy. And if that's not enough to draw you in, we can't be friends. So please stop listening and don't ever talk to me again. But it is a fun movie and it's a great concept. Have you seen that one yourself, Troy?
Yeah. Don Coscarelli, the guy who did the Phantasm movies. That's who did
it.
Yes,
yeah, that's right.
It's a great movie.
Oh, it
it's
is.
Really
it's
fun.
Such a fun, dopey horror movie. But watch it. And it's so well acted, documented, and just having complete balls out fun with the whole concept that Elvis faked his death and had a lookalike sitting in for him for a little bit while he was out just trying to enjoy life. And unfortunately it was the lookalike that died on the crap, leaving him out in the real world. And then I won't disturb or let you know why Ossie Davis is playing JFK, but it's well worth your investment of time. Trust me, there's a lot of stupider movies that we've talked about on this program that were a true waste of your time. This is a fun movie to catch up on. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more to talk about with our guest, Troy Taylor, his book, A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. We continue right here on Darkness Radio. Hey, everybody, listen. Dave and Tim here. We know that these are strange times, but we've got something to make your life a little bit easier. If you haven't already tried it, you've got to get Audible. Audible helps me survive all the travel that I do, all the downtime that I have, and keeps me abreast of some of the coolest and unbelievable stories. I'm a huge biography fan. Tim, I'm listening to Running with the Devil by Noel Monk.
Yeah.
It's the authorized story, if you will, of Van Halen in their heyday, from the 70s to the end of the run with David Lee Roth the first time. This book has it all. Amazing behind-the-scenes stories of Van Halen's rise to fame, crazy antics, and you get an insight into each one of the original members of Van Halen. I grew up in that time. You grew up in that time. It's one of our favorite bands.
Oh, yes.
And Running with the Devil, I can't give it enough credit for being one of the most entertaining audiobooks I've had a chance to listen to in a long time. Also, The Demon Next Door for our true crime fans. As a matter of fact, Brian Burrow is going to be an upcoming guest on True Crime Tuesday talking about this exact case. In a town that he grew up in, it had a dark secret. Brian Burrow digs deep into this murder and this unbelievable character that was a neighbor, a friend, somebody well-respected and well-liked in their community. And what he went on to do, beyond words, Tim. The Demon Next Door by Brian Burrow, another book that I would highly recommend. There's a lot of great ones out there, I got to tell you. And I'm, you know, this sounds like we're flouting it for our buddy. The Best in the World and No is a Four-Letter Word by Chris Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
Our buddy Chris Jericho. Whether you're a wrestling fan or not, this book is for you. Both of these books are for you. No is a Four-Letter Word, The Best in the World. They are so GD funny. They had me laughing out loud from start to finish and enjoyed the life lessons, stories, and everything that Chris Jericho had to share. And he does it as only Chris Jericho, Le Champion, can do. So those were just a couple of the books that I've gone through recently. I Want My MTV, another fascinating expose, if you will, on MTV from its origins, origins, I should say, up until kind of its starting to weaken point in the 90s and early 2000s. You kind of get to hear this wide breadth approach of how it became this cultural phenomena and started music. Really, without MTV, Tim, I don't think the Police, Culture Club, Duran Duran, Wham, I don't think many of these bands that filled our landscapes and are considered classic rock nowadays would even be around today. They probably would have been stuck middling in Europe somewhere. Maybe a few would have made that leap, but without the influence of MTV, music as we know it would not exist. If you don't believe me, listen to the audiobook I Want My MTV by Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks. Those are just some of the ones that I've been listening to recently. I love all of the stories that I get. I am picky, selective, and I love it. I also can tell you this. If there's a book that you get that you're not happy with, they will help replace that audiobook for you. So take your reading to a new level. Enjoy it. And there's nothing like listening to an autobiography or a story told by the person that lived it, Tim.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
It's like you're having a one-on-one friendly conversation. That's why Audible and audiobooks are my absolute favorite thing. So I also want to tell you this, that Audible goes far beyond just audiobooks, okay? Audiobooks, of course, are a major force to what they do, but that's not their entire offering. As a matter of fact, it's far from it. They also have podcasts, guided wellness programs, theatrical performances, A-list comedy, and exclusive Audible originals you cannot find anywhere else. All right. Check out the huge selection that they have. Thousands of titles in every genre, from romance to comedy to horror. If listen, you know, some of the other ones I have, the Alien movies, Tim, are some of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
They've got Audible books that will audiobooks that'll actually tell you the story. It's like you're listening to the movie. Sound effects, music, action, well written. It's amazing. That's what they should be calling it. Amazing Audible, because that's what it truly is. So I want you to visit Audible, because here's what they've got going for you right now. Visit audible.com/BTD or text BTD to 500-500. Folks, I'm telling you, Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to celebrity memoirs, news, business, and self-development. Every month, members get one credit to pick any title, plus two Audible originals from a monthly selection, and access to daily news digests from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, as well as guided meditation programs. And God knows we all need that in our lives right now. So to kick off 2020, they're focusing on New Year, New You, and they have plenty of content that can help you, the audience, pursue your goals, whether it's getting fit, finishing more books, or becoming a better parent, leader, or person. So please, don't just take our word for it, although we wish you would. Go try it for yourself. You're going to thank me. Visit audible.com/BTD BTD, like Beyond the Darkness. Visit audible.com/BTD or text BTD to 500-500.
If you're looking for a fun way to pass the time while engaging your brain and enjoying breathtaking visuals and a gripping story, I've got the answer for you. It's Best Fiends. Let me tell you something. Dave and I have got into this game, not only got into this game, but deep into this game, folks. Once you pick up this game, you are not going to want to put it down. I've got a couple of friends I want to tell you about. Temper and Howie and Quincy, these characters that are in Best Fiends. We get in there and we start blowing away these different, I know I'm going to start talking a language that doesn't sound like English, but start blowing away these different characters and critters and start solving these different puzzles to get to our destination and get to different levels of the game. And it seems like the game is never ending because the higher and higher you go with the different levels, the more rewards you get. I know I don't seem like I'm making much sense right now, do I? But it's so fun. You have no idea. Best Fiends is a casual game that anyone can play, but it is made for adults. I will tell you that much. You can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. That's what's so great about Best Fiends. It really does engage your brain. It's a lot of fun. And there are some challenging puzzles in the game as well. It's not just a shoot 'em up type game. Although, if you do want to get a little bit of your frustrations out, Best Fiends is a good way to do that as well. There's just some times where you just need to blow up some mushrooms or some slugs. There's that in there too. But Dave and I, we take and we compare ourselves when he's on the road and he's doing his thing and I'm here in Minnesota and I'm doing my thing. We compare and contrast as to where we're at in the game. And we keep up on social media. That's the best thing about Best Fiends is we can all keep up with each other on social media. So we can all keep up with each other in the online community of social media together. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. I know with everybody who plays games, you think, you know what, eventually it gets kind of old. You get kind of tired of these games. Best Fiends never gets old. It's always being updated every single month. And the best thing is that Best Fiends doesn't require the internet to play. Like I told you before, Dave plays on the road when he's doing Holzer Files. He'll be playing in a place that doesn't have internet. And then when he gets back to a place where it does have internet, he reconnects and he can update his scores on social media so we can figure out what level he's on and what level I'm on and we can connect that way. But you don't necessarily need internet to play. It's great for traveling. You can play anywhere. You can be on a plane. You can be on the subway. You can be wherever you need to be. And you can keep playing Best Fiends. Again, with Best Fiends, you can collect tons of characters and use them strategically for each level. You have different power levels for different characters, and you can use them on your different missions to get you where you need to go in the game. It's really fun. Again, there's different puzzle levels to the games. It takes you on a different journey and different missions on the games. And again, you really got to get into the game to figure out what it is I'm talking about. Otherwise, it doesn't sound like I'm speaking English. But it's great fun. And I have a lot of fun with Best Fiends. Make sure to engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. It's Best Fiends. Go get it right now at the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Best Fiends. Best Fiends.
So I've got to know, Troy, of all the things you write about, what drew your attention to this is a book I want to write about? What specifically to a guy who's into the supernatural and true crime made you kind of bridge so many different aspects into this book?
Well, I mean, this the subject matter had all of the things in it that I love music. I'm not a musician, but I do love music, and I love history, and I love music history, and there's plenty of supernatural connections, and of course, as it turns out, there's plenty of true crime in here too, because a lot of these people's lives ended quickly and suddenly and tragically. So you have a lot of mysteries and murders and all kinds of stuff mixed in all of this history of the last, you know, dating back to the 1920s. But really, you know, it's the rock era. It's the 60s and 70s that take up a good chunk of this book. You know, not only the 27 Club, but that's when we really started to see, you know, when there had been church groups and things calling Elvis music devil's music in the 50s. But by the late 60s and into the 70s, musicians really just seemed to kind of be embracing the whole idea of the devil's music. And that's when a lot of things started to get mixed in, and a lot of the musicians would live to regret mixing with, you know, some of the supernatural elements, real supernatural elements that they were portraying in their music. You know, the Rolling Stones dipped their toe into, you know, Sympathy for the Devil and all that stuff that they did. And a lot of that came from their, you know, connections and friendships with people who were, you know, involved in, gosh, you know, all kinds of stuff from, you know, real satanic worship to, you know, putting on the show. And that's really what Mick Jagger was doing with this. It was all part of an act. It was all part of, you know, building an audience. But he got involved with this guy named Kenneth Anger, who was a devotee of Aleister Crowley, who shows up about 422 times in the last half of this book. Crowley just mixes in a lot with the 60s and 70s stuff. It was an era where people were looking back at, especially the British musicians, were looking back at some of the black magic things from the turn of the century. And Crowley, of course, was, you know, an integral part of all of that. And Kenneth Anger shows up quite a bit in the book, too. He was a low-budget filmmaker, really, who claimed to be a Satanist. And he really kind of pushed his way into the celebrity crowd of the 60s. He wrote a couple of books that people are familiar with, those Hollywood Babylon books that were big, right. You know, were going around for a while, coffee table size books, just filled with rumors and stories about Hollywood, most of which, you know, weren't true, but they were rumors. And he always said, hey, this is gossip, and this is the gossip I wanted. This is the stuff you're not going to find in the gossip pages. And that's what he really became famous for. But he did a number of films, too. He was trying to get a movie made, Lucifer Rising, and he wanted Mick Jagger to play Lucifer in the film. And, you know, things just... After a while, Mick started to realize that this was a bad idea hanging around this guy, because there had been a lot of bad things that had happened, you know, and you know, I don't even know if I'd call them satanic, but I think he started to get nervous as to how much he was going to delve into this stuff. Anyway, Anger ended up getting, and this is kind of a side note, but he ended up getting someone else to play Lucifer, a young guy whose name was Bobby Beausoleil. Who, if you are a, you know, connected at all or know much about the Manson murders, Bobby was a member of Manson's family and was involved in the Tate and LaBianca murders. So there are a lot of crosses and a lot of connections with a lot of things going on. And, you know, I did a whole section about not only the Stones, but the Manson murders, too, because Manson was a failed musician. You know, who was, that's what he really wanted, was to become a rock star. You know, that's why he palled around and became friends with Dennis Wilson. And, you know, the murder started out to be, you know, revenge, because nobody would give him a record contract. So a lot of the stuff that we know, or we think we know, about the Manson murders, it really boils down to not so much some kind of supernatural or, you know, real religious cult. It really is a cult of personality built around Manson and his failure to be a cool musician, you know, which is really what he wanted. So, but you get into that stuff with a lot of these bands, and these are famous bands. You know, Led Zeppelin is probably the most famously connected to supernatural stuff. And that's all because of Jimmy Page, his obsession with Aleister Crowley. So again, we go back to Crowley again. But Jimmy Page was fascinated with the whole idea. He collected Crowley memorabilia. As you mentioned at the very beginning, he bought Crowley's house on Loch Ness and lived there for a while. I mean, you know, there was a lot going on there. What were you going to say? I'm sorry, Dave.
No, I just said, yeah, right.
I'm aware of this story. So, I mean, he was.
Did he claim that he was influenced by something magical as well for most of the music that he was writing while he was at Crowley's old home?
Yeah, he talked about that stuff a lot. I mean, to the point that I think the rest of the band started to get a little, you know, a little turned off by the whole thing. Because one of the things we see with these bands, and we think of these, you know, this classic Led Zeppelin or somebody like the Eagles or something, a lot of those guys did not get along at all. You know, they worked together and that was it. And we have this illusion that these bands were these really tight, you know, people who spent all their time together. And in this case, especially with Led Zeppelin, these guys were trying to live their own lives. And all they ever heard about was, you know, how they signed a deal with the devil. And that's how they became famous. I mean, that was a huge story for them. And it went around for years. Years and years, people would say it, and there were people who would swear to it that it was true. That's where their fame and fortune came from, and all of that came because of Jimmy Page's obsession with black magic and Satanists and Aleister Crowley. I mean, that was their whole thing, and there was, you know, they would then again try to keep with the theme of this because it brought them a lot of attention. You know, they used a lot of symbols and stuff, and they then left a lot of questions behind as to what all of it meant, you know, because they wanted to make sure that people were, you know, fascinated with the whole thing. And I don't know if you've ever seen, I always suggest people, if they get a chance, to watch the Led Zeppelin film that was made, The Song Remains the Same. Have you ever seen that? They have their own, each of the members of the band have their own, like, I mean, it's a music documentary, but then there are like a music video section where they, you know, are allowed to live out their fantasies of, you know, like Robert Plant is like a knight on a horse and that's his sequence. And, you know, of course, Jimmy Page's is very occult. You know, it's a very kind of dark. I mean, it's really pretentious and terrible. But if you like Led Zeppelin, you should watch it sometime if you get a chance. It's not what you think it'll be whenever you see it. But it is interesting. And you do kind of see the connections of the occult. And that's where the story kind of skews off, because by the 70s, a lot of these guys were tired of Jimmy Page's, I don't know if you'd say his obsession, but at least his fascination and all the publicity that it had brought to the band started to wear on them a little bit, especially when Robert Plant had a number of tragedies in his life. He had a son who was killed, and he had several things that happened, and the newspapers and the tabloids were all blaming these things on, you know, this satanic force that Jimmy Page had brought to the band. And, you know, it was really starting to irritate them. And a lot of that is what led to their breakup. And, you know, John Bonham then died. And again, then they once again blamed Jimmy Page for all this stuff. And that's kind of what, you know, split them up. It was all this stuff, the pressure of all this stuff, and, you know, them getting blamed on, you know, because of their deals with the devil and that kind of garbage, really, is what it boiled down to. It was more of an interest, a fascination, and publicity. Like, you know, I was talking about Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath. That was something that they put on because it looked cool in the early 80s. You know, it wasn't because, you know, it was real. I mean, there were other people that were actually, you know, trying to sell their image on actual black magic. There was a band called Coven that claimed to be witches, and, you know, but most people have never heard of them. They only put out two albums, you know, so the real thing didn't work. But, you know, put up Motley Crue, put up a pentagram on the cover of your Motley Crue album, people are going to buy it, because you're flirting with danger and not necessarily embracing it. And I think that that's sort of what turned most of the band off in Led Zeppelin. And I think that's one of the things that led to them going their separate ways.
you know, seeing this, the bands that tried to embrace the dark side and play with that aspect, even the Beatles on their
Sergeant Pepper's
album, they were originally going to have the devil on the cover somewhere. I think they have Anton LaVey, don't they?
No, they have Aleister Crowley. Crowley on the cover. Yeah.
But of all the really weird people, this has been one that I've heard for a long time. I'm wondering if you can clarify this. Sammy Davis Jr., born a Christian, becomes a Jew, and then, right, because he switches over to Judaism, and then he actually flirted with Satanism for a while, and I heard that he and Sinatra kind of had a falling out about that. As a matter of fact, the old legend lore is that during that time is when they were filming the movie Ocean's 11. And he was going to leave him out. And then he said, fine, I'll put you in the movie, Sam. And he made Sammy Davis Jr. the garbage man. And he gave him a few lines and not much to do. But is there any real information that you were able to uncover that the Candyman was actually part of Satanism at all?
Yes.
Really?
The answer is yes. Okay, so here's the thing. When Anton LaVey started the Church of Satan on April 30th of 1966, his idea of Satanism is not like what you'd see in I'm trying to give you a comparison that people would know, and I mean most people have probably not seen a movie like The Devil Rides Out. It's an old horror film, but it was not. Satanism of Anton LaVey was never really about worshiping the devil. I mean, all of the things that he did, the pentagrams and the shaved head and the cloaks and all that stuff was all, those were the trappings. Those were the fixtures. His Satanism was about doing whatever you wanted to do as long as you didn't hurt other people, not listening to rules made up by other people. As long as you weren't hurting anyone, you could do anything you wanted to. So he ripped off the Aleister Crowley, "Do what thou wilt." And that was, you know, that's the whole of the law. That's kind of what it became. So he attracted, you know, when that started in the 60s, he attracted a lot of interest from, at the time, you know, maybe somewhat fading celebrities like Jane Mansfield. She was deeply involved for a number of years with LaVey and the Church of Satan before her death. And Sammy Davis Jr. became a member of the Church of Satan. But you also have to understand that the people who attended his ceremonies and his meetings, it was like a party. It wasn't, you know, they weren't sacrificing children or anything or goats or anything else. It was usually just a case of getting a bunch of women to lay naked on an altar so that they could serve, you know, wine off the top of them. I mean, these were parties. And there were guys like Ray Bradbury and Forrest Ackerman, you know, the guy that started Famous Monsters. Sure. I mean, these were guys who hung out with him, who went to his parties because it was the in thing to do at the time. So just because Sammy went to the parties, it didn't, I mean, he joined the church, and I've got some photographs of him with Anton LaVey that they took together at some of the parties and things, but it was more of a case of, you know, it was a cool thing to do, man, you know. So yeah, but it is true that he did get involved, and Frank, who was a, you know, was a devout Catholic. I mean, it's just like the way he was, how angry he was with Mia Farrow when she did Rosemary's Baby. It was the same kind of thing. He was mad at Sammy for getting involved with LaVey at all. So, you know, it's the Church of Satan, as far as it went with Anton LaVey and thing, it was never really meant to be anything scary. It was more of, he loved attention. I mean, he loved publicity, and he really loved, you know, the shock effect of what he was doing. And it was a time in American pop culture when, you know, horror films and things were turning to the occult. You know, you had The Exorcist, you had Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, all that stuff was popular around that time. And he was part of that cycle. And it was, you know, the trappings of all of it was the shock factor. But I think he was a guy who had a really good sense of humor and really took a lot of pleasure in, you know, messing with people. But, you know, if you go and read, and then this will sound crazy because I'm not, you know, but if you go and read some of his writings, he really had some really astute things to say. And his rules were a lot kinder than, you know, how to be one of, the, you know, in part of his group. Were a lot kinder than you might find in your local church. I mean, it was all about like helping people and being decent to people. And that is what's going to make, you know, that's what's going to give you good things. If you're a decent person who doesn't hurt people, but if you want to, you know, you want to go out with, you know, four women, you can, as long as nobody gets hurt out of it. I mean, it's just, it was a product of the times, but yeah, Sammy was involved. So you're right about that.
Well, and again, when you think, and this is just broad stroking, when you think devil worshipers in music, right? You might think Rob Zombie, Marilyn Manson, right. even those diabolical knights in Satan's service known as Kiss. That was the big thing right. When I was a kid growing up. I loved Kiss, man. I was a part of the Kiss Army, and my friend's mom was like, oh, you know, that stands for knights in Satan's service. Man. And that, yeah. I got to be honest with you, I was a Christian kid, but that was alluring. I'm like, they're
well,
what?
Sure. And, sure. Cover of and it wasn't Destroyer, true, but still.
Right. Yeah. The cover of Destroyer, where they're standing there kind of frolicking over flames and the women reaching up out of the, oh, yeah, that's what she was telling. This is hell. This is, you know, I was like, what? This is, oh, I want to know more. Even though it wasn't about the demonic side, it was just that enticement. But when I think of dark side and I think of evil and true Satanists, there's only one name that leaps to mind. Liberace. Right. Yeah, what the hell? Is he really a Satanist as well?
I don't know about that one. I hadn't heard that. But you know, it was the same time period. So, I mean, he certainly could have attended some of the same parties, but
one of the things that popped up was, I looked this up a while ago because I have an article about strange connections in Hollywood. That's why I knew about Sammy. Yeah. Liberace was one of, according to the article, was one of the earliest members of the Church of Satan. Yeah, and he was a very close friend of Anton LaVey. Just funny, right? But you just think
it is
all
funny.
The world for Liberace to be one.
A lot of our imagery and things we think about with Satanists and things come out of when we were in school. I mean, because I think you went to school in the early 80s too, right?
You
were in school. Yeah. So that's what we heard about, was that, you know, if you played records backward, there were satanic messages. There were Satanists everywhere, the Geraldo specials and things. And it was this diabolical, you know, evil underground that was kidnapping children and committing murders. And, you know, all this stuff came out of this repressed memory stuff that was popular at the time, where people were having these memories of, you know, being in bed and their parents coming in with all their country club friends wearing black robes and forcing them to have babies and using them for sacrifices. And, you know, all of it turned out to not be true. And but that
satanic really, panic.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly it. And it bled over into music heavily, which is why guys like Motley Crue and Ozzy Osbourne, you know, they were taking advantage of the press around this stuff and putting out records that our parents didn't want us to listen to, because they were satanic, you know, even though they really weren't. And these guys were about as far from Satan or, you know, what was being portrayed as Satanists at the time as you could possibly imagine. But it did put, you know, an image in our heads, and it affected a lot of people, especially like fundamentalist Christians who believed what they were hearing on the radio or believed what they saw in the Geraldo special about Satan, the satanic underground and things. And that really colored a lot of the last part of this book, because that's what we were dealing with when I was a teenager. That's the kind of atmosphere that everything had secret messages in it. And if you played them backwards, you would hear things, and, you know, or these songs had secret meanings, you know, they were putting everybody into that category. And it was a crazy time. It was a really crazy time to be a kid. And that was the stuff we had to deal with at the time, you know, and trying to listen to music we wanted to listen to have your records confiscated by people because they were satanic. I mean, bands like Styx, you know, it's like, come on, you know, I mean, give me a break, you know, but there's a lot of that, you know.
With that said, we have one of the darkest foes walking amongst us still today, still out touring with his demonic little partner, Daryl Hall.
Right.
To that, I guess, from, again, with the articles and stuff I was reading into when I was trying to figure all this out, he was big into it in his solo album. They said he references Aleister Crowley through a couple of the songs. He believed that his great grandfather was a warlock. Okay. And he actually talks about it in an interview that he did. But that he believed he was a warlock or of warlock blood. It's just, it's funny to me. Again, you,
right.
The people right. you think, I'm just waiting for John Tesh's name to get thrown out there, right?
Or Jan, yeah.
Which Jan, it would make sense. Then we'd know how he got Linda Evans in the 80s, well, right?
Right, yeah.
Very strange. Does it surprise you? I mean, I guess I should rephrase the question. Of the work and research you did, what aspects of this did surprise you, or names or people associated?
Wow. Gosh, not a lot. I don't think I got a lot of surprises out of it. I think I was, but some of the stories or some of the connections that I didn't realize existed, some of those were weird, you know, when you got into, you know, like all the stories that David Bowie used to tell about how he was, a magician and he was apparently at war for a while with someone. And I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was Jimmy Page. That they were having a warlock war for a while between each other. Of course, that was the story. And then Bowie used to, I mean, he was on some diet where he only drank champagne and snorted Coke. And that was his diet. And he would do that for weeks at a time. And then his ex-wife, Angie, we talked about this time when he claimed that there was a demon in their swimming pool and all this stuff. I'm just thinking, wow. I mean, I think I probably would too if that was my diet, you know, if that's what I was functioning on. So some of the stories had to be included because they were just so weird and so funny. But yeah, I don't know. I would have been surprised if I had run across the Liberace thing. That would have surprised me. Yeah. It surprised me when you just told me. So but yeah, there's, you know, a lot of this stuff, it just, you, as you start to find just how deep it goes into, you know, and how much of it turned out to be just rumors, you know, a lot of this stuff did, because I mean, while Jimmy Page was, yes, fascinated with all this stuff, there were a lot of things said about the band and stuff that didn't happen or weren't for real. And when you find out that Mick Jagger was terrified of all this stuff, even though he was, you know, putting on the show, but once it started to get real, he got out of it quickly, you know. So it's interesting to find some of the personalities and things involved, and you know who did what and who didn't do what. And it was a fun book to research. It was a fun book to write. And every once in a while, there are books that I'm sorry that I finish, you know, because they're just so much fun to work on that you hate to be done with them. And this was one of them. This was one of those books I'd been talking about writing for a few years, and I finally got around to it. It was on my bucket list. And then by the time it was done, I was like, oh, man, you know, well, maybe I should dig up some more. No, it's you're good. So sometimes you just have to know when to quit.
Well, you know, people don't realize, too, the connection to music and the supernatural, how powerful it really is. I mean, in sure. some of the first recordings ever made, that's where we started getting EVP, wasn't it? The guy trying to record bird sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and his name is eluding me right now, but was it Rodive?
Jorgensen,
right.
I think. Yeah, he was an opera singer. Yeah.
And they would record, and all of a sudden they would have these strange voices appearing on recording mm-hmm. that they could make no sense of. So it's been a part of it. And talking to musicians throughout the years in private and on public and on the radio, it's so interesting how many of them feel as though they are connected to something supernatural when they're writing and how it comes to them at times.
Right. And the way music plays such an important role in ceremonies and services. I mean, whether or not, I mean, I guess you could put religion into a supernatural category, but, you know, any kind of ceremony has to involve music. And that's where, you know, people believe that the spirits, whether it's a seance has always had music. And people believe that it makes things easier. Voodoo ceremonies, I mean, it's all about the drums and the rhythm. Same way with like a Pentecostal church. I mean, if you believe in that sort of thing, when people become possessed by the spirit at a Pentecostal church, it's because they've been worked up by drums and pianos and everything else for a half an hour. So music is super involved with the supernatural and always has been. So, you know, I took a look at kind of the darker side of it with this book, but, you know, it plays a role on both sides of the supernatural, both the light and the dark side of it. And they're always going to be linked.
What can you tell us? What are some of the, before we let you off the hook here too early, what are some of the creepier aspects that you uncovered in the book?
Well, most of that stuff had to do with, most of it I found creepy. In we get into the 60s and you get into some of these stories about some of the bands, especially with the Rolling Stones, because they, you know, especially Mick really kind of embraced this stuff at first. He got scared because of some of the things that were happening with Kenneth Anger, who was a weird dude anyway. And I think that for the most part was at the time was completely full of crap about most of the things he claimed he could do, but he knew how to manipulate people and he knew how to make them believe that what he was doing was real. And I think that some of that stuff and some of the things that they reported and some of their crew, a lot of the times it wouldn't be Mick who would tell the story, but it'd be somebody, a member of the band or somebody who was part of the crew or one of the managers or something would talk about. They were at this party and he was at a party and the Stones were there. And he said that he saw Kenneth Anger at the party and he went to talk to him and then he couldn't find him. And then it turned out that Anger had been in another country at the time of the party and had shown up, you know, a week or so later. And this guy was positive that he had seen him at the party that night. And Anger claimed that he had dropped in. Now, whether or not he was lying or not, these people, they all believed it. And I found that some of that stuff was really creepy. And some of the things that they would get involved with, the accidents that took place, the bad luck they started to have when they started to try to push this guy out of their lives. And that was some weird stuff. It really was. And, you know, even just getting back into some of those curses and stuff. And when I was laughing about, you know, some of them are a stretch. You really have to use your imagination to turn them into something other than coincidence. But on the other hand, like we said, so many people dying at the same age, but it wasn't even so much that the Grand Ole Opry thing really is freaky. And it really freaked out a lot of people at the time. And why that particular, you know, there's nothing about the building that is the curse, but whatever was going on was happening to performers who performed there. And, you know, the list of the people who died is even longer than most of the other curses in the book, because they lived so, you know, some of them lived tragic lives or, you know, live hard, die young kind of lives, but some of them didn't. And they were still kind of caught up in this, you know, burned to death in their trailers and, you know, killed in car accidents lifestyle. It makes you wonder if when you finish this book, it sometimes makes you wonder if all the fame and fortune is worth it, you know, with a lot of these cases. I mean, you get into the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd and stuff and you question, you know, what's happened to some of those people. I mean, some of them ended up in mental hospitals and, you know, in early deaths. And you're thinking, was it really worth it? You know, was it worth it? I don't know. So I don't know. It makes you think. But on the other hand, it's a lot of fun. we'll go with that, okay?
Well, and, you know, it looks as though, you know, when you dig through some of these stories, that musicians have found inspiration in many places. Sometimes the darker parts of culture is a way to examine who we are as humans. You can't always just talk about love and light and romance. And, you know, sometimes it's in that darker underbelly that the most fascinating characters will spring to life in musical songs. And I understand to a degree why you've got bands like Motley Crue and Judas Priest and Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath and things that are trying to draw the attention, almost in the same way that that LaVey was doing, right?
Right.
Look, we're going to throw something flashy at you. You're going to look in mock horror and astonishment, but you might learn something. Yeah. You might read and see in the liner notes something else. And I know David Lee Roth, I just listened to an entire book called Running with the Devil on Van Halen. But David Lee Roth had made comments about feeling influenced by demons at points in life. You know, and that I don't recall that in the book, but I remember reading about that in a few of the articles. Now, again, are they misquoting and, you know, sure. Is this becoming a, you know, we're bigger than Jesus thing like John Lennon the Beatles and being totally misconstrued? I'm not certain. But, you know, when exploring these different facets of music, it's not surprising. And I got to tell you, I'm in no way, shape or figuratively or anything, a fan of the devil himself. The song Sympathy for the Devil, though, is a fascinating song.
It is.
It is. Giving that other concept and looking in the examination of why we believe this is good and that's bad. What really is the devil and what you know, where does it live? And maybe that's it. Maybe it's in those pockets in between, the places where you know, we subjectively input our own thoughts. That's where the devil lives. By reading into something that isn't there, that's giving the devil power.
Right. True. That's absolutely true. I mean, I wrote a whole massive book on the devil. And, you know, by the time I was finished it, I had convinced myself that the devil is us, you know, that we are what gives power to anything bad that happens. The same way you just said it. I mean, I think it's what we allow to happen, what we bring into things is the evil that men do. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, there's a couple of famous quotes where it says, you know, who knows who the devil is? It's hard to say because God has all the best books. So we don't ever get his side of the story. So, yeah, I don't know, man. The stuff is fascinating and it does make you think that there's something out there that influences things. But definitely with music, it was a fun book to write. So that's where we ended up.
Very cool. As we go out, let's wrap up with one other aspect. I mean, right now, above all, witchcraft. True witchcraft, Wiccan, and that environment seems to have regained a new footing and popularity as a religion. And, you know, one of the most outspoken people in this field seems to be Stevie Nicks with this. Now, do you know much about that? I mean, is this something
you know what?
More of a fascination or what?
Yeah, I didn't. And, you know, that was funny because I didn't include her in the book because I really like Stevie Nicks, and she has really kind of embraced that whole thing, that whole the white witch thing, you know, with American Horror Story and stuff, and plays on a character. But she has always said she's always maintained she's not really a witch. And because of the interviews she kept giving, and I kept finding more and more of them in her own words, I decided I would not include her in the book just because it seemed like something that she was saying she wasn't. So why are we still calling her one, even though that seems to be a persona that she created, much like Mick Jagger did, you know, with this satanic thing, even though he wanted nothing to do with it. So that's why I didn't include her, because I think that while supernatural, the kind of witchcraft or like Wicca that has become a popular thing again, I don't know if I would consider it to be something supernatural because of the themes more about nature and, you know, the natural world than it does in creating magic. Although there seems to be 100 variations of that too. And a lot of it, unfortunately, I find that even back in the 60s, when all of the witchcraft stuff really got popular in the first place, there were a lot of people out there claiming to be witches who really weren't. Because it's great to get attention that way. It's kind of like rock stars saying that they're Satanists, you know? So I don't know, but I did leave her out, but that's why, is because she repeatedly said she wasn't a witch. So there you go.
Good enough for me. Good enough for you. A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. Can I ask you real quickly before we do head out? There is that what is that set of notes that's played that they actually think evokes ghost communication?
It is called the tritone. It was a certain interval in music, and it was the augmented fourth interval of the tritonus. That was what it was called. And I'll just read you from a note here. The tritone Please. Was defined as a musical interval composed of three adjacent whole tones. One specific kind of tritone, the augmented fourth interval, spans across three whole steps in the scale. Before composers began using major and minor scales, this interval was considered so unnatural, it was named the devil's interval. And it was actually believed it could summon the devil. But it is, it's the opening notes to Purple Haze. That is exactly what that is. The fourth augmented interval. That's it. So when you hear that beginning of how it takes off, that's what that is. Or an example of it.
Is it the tritone too? Is that the one that was banned by churches?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. They were not allowed to use that in any written music at the time and played in a church because it was believed that it would summon the devil because of that delay.
Wow. Very strange.
I had to learn. I don't know anything about writing music or sheet music or anything. So I had to have a crash course in it just to write that section of the book because I had no idea what it was talking about. I had to find examples so that when I heard it, then I would understand it. And because I honestly did not know what it was. So interesting. It did turn out to be interesting. So so I do learn things working on this stuff. So
very cool. Well, the book, there's a link for it. We have a link to Troy Taylor's website on today's show. Troy, thanks again, man. It was great catching up with you. And let's do it again soon.
Yep. Sounds good. All right. Take care, guys.
Thank you, folks. That's it for this week. We are done. We'll be back with you Tuesday. More of the best in true crime talk radio next week, and more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And please, in this time, if I could just make a quick plea to you. Folks, this could be a time of darkness and a time of panic and a time of worry, or we could all look at the chance that we have been given this chance to come back together as a people and a community. And I hope that you'll take this time to reintroduce yourself to your family, to your children, to your parents, to your brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, and get to know one another. I think it's an important part in our history, and this could be what separates us. It's not this hit and this massive impact of a virus that's going to define our future. It's how we come back out of it that will. And let's come back out of it better. Let's come back out of it more in touch with our family and friends, less associated with our electronics and our communication and texting to people that are millions of miles away, when there are people right within the four walls of our own homes that probably know us less than those people that you chat with every day. Take this time to reconnect with yourself and with the people in your home. All right. I hope that you'll consider doing that. Be safe, be kind to yourselves and one another. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. That's Tim. I'm Dave. This is Darkness Radio.